Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung. Frankfurt kitchen or self-designed?
Good pair. I tend to go self-designed, but in opposition to Frankfurt kitchen. I mean, which is to say, I care about the Frankfurt kitchen, but I think that it's troubled in the 21st century as a way forward.
Art or architecture?
Always architecture.
Accomplice or service provider?
Oh, accomplice is really nice. I love that. That also gives a lot of credit to my clients, which, you know, frankly, they deserve.
In 1963, the book Community and Privacy, Toward a New Architecture of Humanism, edited by Serge Chermayeff and Christopher Alexander, was published. In their detailed analysis, they propose a new kind of urban order structured to provide clearly delineated areas in which different human needs in hierarchies, wrangling from public urban life to individual solitude, can be met without interference or conflict with other activities. These are intended to create a rational order of physical relationships based on human qualities. It's a coincidence that 61 years after the book's publication, we, Diane Slavich and Katharina Beatrice Wager, meet the publisher's grandson, Sam Chermayeff, in our podcast today to once again talk about community and privacy. Sam is also an architect, designer, and educator, and is particularly interested in how we can renegotiate private spaces to make our lives more open.
Hello and welcome to today's Zoom Talks podcast. We're really glad to have you with us, Sam.
Happy to be here.
Sam Chermayeff, if you haven't heard this name before, you haven't leafed through architecture journals for a long time. After all, he and his office partner, Johanna Meyer Grobrügge, have built what is probably the most exciting building in Berlin at the moment, the Kufu Building Group on Kurfürstenstraße in Berlin. Tell us briefly what you have realized there and what makes it so special.
Well, back to your original word pairs, you know, my accomplices, my clients, our clients, Johanna and I's clients, we managed all together to build a 25-unit apartment building on a fairly rough corner of the city with kind of a north-facing facade on a, you know, place where you can still buy drugs. And it's sort of Berlin in its Berlinness on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's a kind of bourgeois fantasy to the south in the other way. And so we've made a kind of glass building that, you know, in its best sense is folding in and out of the street and extremely open both to the roughness and the sort of prettiness of Berlin at once. And we did it over a 10-year period, and a community was born out of our collective project, right? Because it's most people's life savings, including mine. And I live here and work here, and Johanna owns my flat together with me. And we, as a group of people, made a building such that we overlap each other quite a bit. So we have somebody else's bedroom is sort of the physical center of my flat, and the flats kind of fold in on each other, and you see your neighbors, and you have quite a strong sense of the other people. It's a place where you're not alone. And so going backwards by accident, I mean, I didn't set out this way, but I really am tackling the exact same questions that my grandfather was in Community and Privacy, sort of thinking through what private space needs to be and what public space needs to be from a point of view, indeed 60 some years later, where we have a kind of epidemic of loneliness, actually. I don't know that I set out to address that epidemic of loneliness, only that I'm coming at, you know, trying to make density in a city which at the time, so 10 years ago, Berlin, you know, was full of gaps. And you really felt that Berlin then was a city built for several million more people than were here. So you had this feeling that it was still kind of an open place. I mean that spiritually also, but quite literally, giant streets. I mean, the whole scale of the city, despite it being from the point of view of a Manhattanite, you know, quite a dense city, still these broad, big streets were also sort of empty. And you can still go on the subway and, you know, more or less always get a seat. And so we're part of this filling out of the kind of remnants of a series of pretty big screw-ups in Berlin over the 20th century. But we're also sort of partly celebrating the 20th century in a certain way. I mean, we're certainly not rejecting modernism here. So our building is trying to play with the boundary in the rules and in the feeling of the place between the 19th century planning, all kinds of 20th century ideas, and that all together sort of makes it special, I guess, I hope.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the reasons why you became one of the finalists for the DAM Award. So your project is one of the five best projects we found for Germany for 2024. So it's definitely worth to go there and visit it because it's really, really a very special place.
And you can, I mean, of course you can ring my doorbell, but you can also really get the idea from just standing in front in a quite clear way if you kind of go around and you really look in the doors and windows because it's quite open.
It's not quite open. It's completely, really open. But your answer, Sam, leads me to our next question, as if you knew what I was going to ask you. You said in an interview that the architecture doesn't force people to live together or to share. How do you ensure that in practice?
It's a series of lucky decisions, perhaps. I mean, we have private space. So one of the parameters that we decided early on was that we should have rather bigger spaces in the house and rather smaller spaces. So like quite an extreme conditions within given units, which is, you know, sort of in opposition to the classic Berlin Altbau, which no shade onto it, only that, you know, bedroom is a dining room, is a living room. They were built for renting, so they have no closets. They have very little distinction between rooms, and bathrooms and kitchens in general are half of one of those bays. So essentially, if you didn't have pipes, you could rip out the bathroom and the kitchen, and that would also be a bedroom. Proportionally, those are all the same kind of space. And so we made these extreme spaces, and then these extreme spaces make smaller being more private, larger being more public. So the double high, really open, larger spaces face the street or the backyard or the facade in either direction. And then sort of tucked away, you know, one way to call it in the audio way is like a nooks and crannies sort of tucked back in there. So we have this kind of layering of private public inside the flat. And that relates to both the street and the neighbors because the building is also a jagged facade that comes from a rotated grid that's very difficult to grasp in a podcast. But, you know, you look at a picture, you get the idea. So you end up where one apartment is jutting out past the next in the outside. And then inside, those same apartments are sort of jutting into each other, allowing a lot of density, but also really big spaces and the small spaces like overlap each other. And so the overlaps can belong either way. Like I said earlier in an answer, or maybe I was just saying why it's special, but it's quite nice how people's flats are like inside your flat in a way, like they're poking into each other. And then from the outside, you see into your neighbor's flat all the time. And I didn't know that that would be nice, actually. You know, I mean, in fact, our clients at several points asked, is that going to work out and so forth? And I did sort of look into my grandfather's book about it. And I was more flexible about it than not and said, like, you know, it's outside. You're looking through, you know, outside air and you can put a curtain and it'll be fine. But it turns out that it's really nice to just know that your neighbor's home by their light on. You know, it's not so much light that you can read in your flat from your neighbor's light. It's not disturbing you. But you have a sense of that togetherness and you have a sense in my particular flat or in quite a few flats, you really have like eight different people who you can know that they're home if you want to go look from inside my flat. And that helps in a major way with isolation. And as a result, I think people are friends. I think people actually invite other people to dinner more than they do in other buildings. I mean, that's partly because of the process of building it together and, like, let's say, some general pride about the place. But I think it's also because people are aware of each other, as opposed to what, like, a lot of students ask me, which I'm not exactly against. Like, we don't have, you know, a ping pong table room. Nothing against ping pong. But we don't have, like, a ton of shared space. I mean, the lobbies are very generous. But in a sense, the whole thing is shared.
So there's not, like, one community space?
No, not really. Of course, we consider that, and we do collectively own one of the commercial spaces, which we can theoretically use as a communal, what have you. But in fact, it's more about the communal nature of it on a day-to-day interaction level. And again, it's generous, the public space, but it's not about making people do stuff together, right? So we don't have like a schedule to fix the garden. Some people like to do that, and then they do that, and then they work it out. And there's a whole bunch of plants on the roof and strawberries and all kinds of nice things. And the people who like it deal with it, and the people who don't care don't. I tend to sort of stay out of the gardening just because I see that other people enjoy it. And so I thank them and I ask them to send me a message when the lettuce is ready for a salad. But that's about it. But nonetheless, because it's so open and you see each other, we do have a lot of interaction. And the way that it folds in on the courtyard side, you hear and see all the other people also playing and the kids hear each other. And so like my kids come here and then they see the other kids and they immediately want to go out. It's very like connected to the outside. We're connected to each other more than having like allotted places for that.
I do have another question on that, because you're actually talking about the result of living together, that it works. But in advance, how hard was it to find the group? Because I guess like 99% of the people don't want to make any compromises when it comes to living and certainly don't want to share rooms like without delimitation. And as we heard, at least 19 other parties, right, have come together in the building to share this kind of experiment.
It's 25 minutes. You know, somebody naive like Johanna and I, late 20s, early 30s, to build quite a big thing, not really knowing properly how to do it. That's the bigger risk than the community and privacy thing, to be perfectly honest with you. People, at least on paper, are certainly willing to do a fair bit spiritually. You know, capitalism gets in the way. In the end, a Baugruppe starts out as this very communal thing, and the community is indeed in the making. So it's in this discussion and all these meetings to be like, is this okay? Does this work? And people went with it. But in the end, they're somehow trusting on the fact that it becomes an asset. And that's a little bit depressing. I mean, on some level, I wish it were a Genossenschaft with shares, but I don't know how you do that process without that asset at the end, because it's very independent. There's no government funding. The land was bought from a guy who had a used car dealership on the ground. I mean, it happened to be, as I said, a rough corner. So the land price remains a relatively small percentage of the final cost. So there's that. That's a big deal and makes it very, very hard to do again in, well, any German city now. I mean, any big German city, the land prices move much faster than they did at the time of this acquisition. But the community part, I mean, I did talk to every single artistically inclined person in all of Berlin at that time, which was very good for business in general, because I made a lot of friends and connections, and people later asked us to do, you know, gallery designs and certainly kitchens and other interiors. And, you know, I mean, a good number of our other projects come from pitching this project to everybody who would listen at the time. People were excited about it even before it happened. And I think people were interested in something new. I mean, there's a big cabal of, let's say, 19th century related architects building in Berlin since Stimmon in the 90s. There's Brandelhuber, there's a few other architects trying to figure out what is contemporary architecture in a German context in terms of living. But it's not a big world. I mean, I don't want to credit the community privacy part of it. I think people were just excited about something new, including us. I didn't know exactly how this would feel. That's why I do talk about the result. I definitely sold all those things, but I also at the same time said, like, let's talk about your cozy bathroom and let's talk about how grand this space is going to be. And let's talk about how nice the light is, you know, very classic questions. At the same time, as you know, with everybody in architecture is a salesmanship job. On some level, regrettably sometimes, but just to give them full credit, they were really into it. Accomplices.
Which is pretty awesome to find a group of people who are able, like, first of all, they're willing, and then it even works out.
Yeah, I'm amazed that it works out. I mean, and meanwhile, and then to just like small anecdote, but then when we discuss like the lobby furniture now, I mean, the whole giant complicated building with pretty radical spaces. And, you know, nobody can agree on what kind of bench to put in the lobby, which is incredible. It's so hit or miss, except somehow collectively it happened.
There is one member of the building group who I think everybody should know, the publisher Lars Müller. He's also a resident in the building, and he said something very nice that he no longer wants to own, but to use. So another special feature on the project is that the rooms, with the exception of the bathroom cells, are not predetermined and are therefore open to all uses. That's what you already told us before. Now, after a while, you're living in this building and using the space. Would you say that this might be the future of living?
I hope so, on some level. I mean, it's a fairly radical thing that there are very, very few coming on zero interior walls, meaning the bedrooms are open in a New Yorker way, you would call them lofts. But of course, you can close space in various ways after the fact, and people do. I do think that it's important to make flexibility, but again, it's not a shell with no direction, meaning you can put your kitchen kind of wherever you want. Actually, there's like an extra shaft partly to like add this flexibility per different people's imaginations, but there's still extremes of difference. And, you know, sort of there's still spatial conditions that suggest not a program specifically, you know, not sort of this is a place that you definitely want to sleep or not, or this is a place where you definitely don't want to. On the contrary, not at all. But there are different feelings in these spaces, right? So you really feel where I'm sitting right now, sort of at the edge looking towards the street, you feel like you're on a cliff edge falling off. Like it's not cozy, at least not in the daytime. You know, in the night, you get a different reflection. And then another place feels really, really tight and compressed. And I think that the success of the no prescription works because there is at least the ability to make different interpretations on your own. So you invite people to have some feeling about where they want to be at different moments. But those feelings are not necessarily connected to programming. It's a tiny bit abstract. And then I go on to sort of when people start to feel it and figure it out, like, making everybody has quite particular kitchens and in particular positions, sometimes in a high place, sometimes in a low place. Sometimes people sleep rather closer to the facade or more tucked in. And that depends on who they are, you know, this gradient of their experience. Yes, I guess that is the future of living. Because we prescribe a lot as architects, typically, more than Johanna and I have here, for sure.
Well, hospitality concepts already adapted a lot of that community thinking. You know, referring to temporary living, but really designing a concept for constantly living in a community space is a very interesting aspect about the future of living.
Yeah. I mean, you remember a few years ago, there was like a lot of discussion, particularly in like the Anglo-Saxon world and like New York and London, where real estate is just even more ridiculous than here, you know, where people would have like bedrooms and then shared kitchens as permanent concepts. I mean, I'm very taken by that. Back to like that quote from Lars, you know, he needs a lot of space for books and stuff, but he doesn't really care. You know, he's happy to put his bathrobe on and walk down a hall to fry an egg. He doesn't have to do that, but in principle, he would. And I think a lot of people would, you know, not to mention a lot of people are traveling around all the time, including me. At the time, you know, everybody took EasyJet everywhere, which was super problematic for the environment. But now suddenly there's night trains to everywhere. So Lars has a house in Northern Italy and, of course, in Zurich, where his office is. And so that's where the use thing kind of comes in. The kind of mobility of people is connected perhaps to this idea of use and is maybe different from like my grandfather's time. It's funny, the house that he built not long after that Community and Privacy was published was in New Haven. He was teaching at Yale just after that. It was just up for sale like a month ago, and it sold in like a week. And it was his private house. It's a really nice house, and I don't want to knock my own grandfather, but one wonders if it would have been much cooler if like he'd had two or three other families living there. And I think if you look at the diagrams in Community and Privacy, they're about this kind of layering of connection. Not dissimilar from here, but I think we make more connection in this house. But I think that that's partly because of how people live now. I mean, I think he stayed in New Haven. You know, there was just less mobility on a weekly basis. I mean, I really did see Lars in Milan last week. It's a reflection of our time, but then you travel all the time and you also feel disconnected. you'd think that you'd feel connected by meeting people and being mobile. But on the other hand, you need grounding. So that our house talks about the grounding and the openness at once, ideally.
Sam, before you came to Berlin, you lived in Japan for 5 years and worked with Katsuyo Sejima and Ryu Nishizawa.
Rue Nishizawa, yeah.
Probably the most important protagonist of contemporary construction. How much Sana is there in that building?
There's a lot, but there's some distinct differences, which are not like better or worse. Just, I mean, the first thing is that they are rigorous people, like truly, truly rigorous people. And they work hard, to put it lightly. And so this building also comes from setting parameters that I've already mentioned, big and small, the north and the south, messing around with what's 19th century, what's contemporary, what are the rules. And then we made, you know, quite literally 1,000 parties in model form, because we also had time back then. Now, it would be hard to work like that. So they worked on parties, and they work in a way that you can understand the parameters and the decisions sort of at a scale of 1 to 100. I think in the exhibition for the Dam Prize, you have a 1 to 50 model. But in fact, there's nothing in this building that isn't more or less figured out in that 1 to 50 model. Okay, the heater doesn't show up there. And the heater's nice, but it's not the point. So they wouldn't really talk about community and privacy, but what they care about deeply and taught us to care about besides the rigor is a kind of in-between spaces and soft divisions. So we're trying very, very hard to design the building such that you feel the outside coming in and you feel like you're partly outside. So this gradient difference between the cozy and the rough street is essentially a sauna. Or I came to realize later that that's a whole Japanese idea. If you think about Katsura, like the famous, or any very old Japanese house, they have an ingawa space, the Japanese word, sort of between the outside wall and the paper wall. It's not exactly a hallway, and it has something to do with temperature, but it also has to do with a gradient between the closed and the open. And that has to do with seasonality, et cetera, et cetera. But then, which I really like, which is a very different thing, is we're trying here to deal with the sort of realities of European, maybe more specifically German construction, which is, it's very thick, literally. And in Sana, we would spend, you know, untold hours trying to convince clients and facade companies and so on to get everything just so and very filigrane and very light. And our building doesn't try to do that per se. We're also kind of sticking with the reality of a kind of industrial system that exists here, which we actually quite care for. I mean, I really like it. And there's quite a few architects around Europe. I mean, Brandel Huber, who I already mentioned, you know, maybe it's also in the language of an architecture office in France called Brutea. I hope that they would agree with that. I think they like it. You know, trying to kind of use what's available with some intelligence. And trying to kind of compose space and, well, facade and everything by the logic of industrialization. You know, Sana and Japan in general is like, you know, interested in a sort of endless refinement. And Germany's not interested in endless refinement, which is fine. It's not really the goal. It's more about systems here. And it took us a long, long time to learn that, actually, because Sejima, you know, she's interested in refinement to the point of abstraction. You know, in a model that she would make at 1 to 50, the glass would be as if it doesn't exist, but it does. You know, we had to learn that. Obviously, there's cost in that, and they achieved a kind of level of fame. Fame is not the right word. They just have a certain set of projects that allow them to refine that endlessly. And actually, that's not the case in living. This house is not a model for anything in particular, and it's very site-specific, but it also could be. It also isn't trying to be the most refined version of itself.
Let's jump from Tokyo back to Berlin. You said in an interview that the answer to most interior challenges lies in designing better furniture. Your furniture designs are definitely different from what was currently on display, for example, at the Salone in Milan. So how do you design a kitchen that is not a kitchen, but can still be used as a kitchen?
All architects, including me, you start off, particularly in Europe, designing kitchens as offset lines from walls. So it's a 60 centimeter blocks in a line that's offset about 65, so you can get the machine in the pipe. And that comes from the Frankfurt kitchen to then somewhere along the way, the Deutsche Industry Norm to Neufritt, to a kind of series of industrial decisions that were made. And contrary to what I just said about, you know, the facade materials or other things, those are industrial decisions that we're not, at least I wasn't aware of, and I certainly didn't agree to. And I don't think that any society like agreed to that individually at all. I think that like somehow a kind of cabal of decisions where like Siemens can't make an oven that doesn't fit in an IKEA box because that doesn't work, and IKEA boxes can't be different because the ovens won't fit, and that they all agreed, you know, which is fair enough. I mean, that's what modernism is about. It's about like making all of us the same. And I'm not entirely against that, but it turns out not to be true. Like, we're not all the same. And it turns out that you don't have to do it. So I started to deconstruct it. I started to say, like, you just don't have to do it that way. You can kind of pile things up. You know, there's a whole notion that comes from the Frankfurt kitchen about cleanliness. And there's also an idea embedded that we want to cook to get it done, to get on to whatever else. And it turns out like whatever else is like more shopping on Amazon. You know, like, what could you possibly want to find joy in other than actually cooking? Like, it's in fact the nicest thing to do. So we started to make kitchens that were starting from the celebration of alone or together of people doing these actions rather than trying to find the fastest possible way to boil an egg, which is a fair goal of modernism. And maybe that needed to happen. But 100 years later, we actually need the inefficiency to celebrate. So that's how that came to pass. And it's actually been 10 years that I've been working on it. And we're still working on it and still kind of figuring out that deconstruction. I mean, it turns out like it's not that big of a deal if it's dirty under your oven and you can once a year go and clean it. But we took in this notion, again, 100 years ago, that you can't have dirt under there or that it's a problem. And actually, once you start living it, it's not. And so it's sort of an upending of a kind of ideology that happened completely by chance. And then what turns out to be really nice is that, you know, going back to the architect thing, architects, including myself, build these big buildings and blah, blah, blah. And like, I don't want to make crazy things inside my already crazy thing, right? So I tend to say like, hey, you in this house, on the whole, most of the time, people just built like a pretty normal kitchen. And sometimes we made fun ones, but our real clients now are other architects who want to have this discussion and this accomplished thing in their projects. So we do kitchens for Brandehuber. We're doing for Solid Objectives in New York, their kitchen. We're doing, Bjarke Engels called the other day for his private house to do an indoor and an outdoor kitchen, because somehow it's another field and a different place where people didn't recognize that you could take lessons, because it's a pain in the ass because again, the world is set up. So it does take a fair bit of work to undo it. I mean, we even work for this company Reform, which I really like, but their principle is that you buy IKEA bodies and you stick fancy architect fronts on or tops. And it's very nicely done, but it's almost a doubling down of the idea of like the given infrastructure. It's a very smart take on the infrastructure. And now they make their own bodies and so on. But the bodies, of course, fit the ovens. So they're not deconstructing it. They're in fact just adding another surface layer. I don't hold that against them. And we're trying to add functions to the surface layer. But what I'm trying to get at is it attracts people to like upend the kitchen, basically. I mean, and there's a lot of things to talk about. Again, like to go back and to repeat myself, what are you going to do with the efficiency? Like really think about it. Like, what are you going to do with the extra time? Might as well have like the most joy you can. And so all of our furniture in the kitchens is sort of joy, but it's still programmatic. It's still joy in chopping. It's still joy in frying. It's still celebrating a kind of action. It's not, you know, it's not meant to be a pain in the ass for the sake of it.
Do you prefer beginning or finishing things?
I don't really believe it until it's done. So I need to have it done in order to like get the kick. And that scales, meaning like I'm still getting the kick out of this building. So like 10 years work, several years kick. Kitchen, you know, scales down, you know, chair scales down more. But I need to know that it's going to be real. Like I don't care about the image unless it's real. So I don't know which one I prefer, but I need the end. I need to believe in the end. it's not speculative. I mean, it's speculative in the sense that, like, I'm not 1,000% sure that it's going to work out exactly how I imagine. In fact, it never works out exactly how I imagine. In the best case, it works out better, or let's say slightly differently. And that's extremely attractive to me. And I need clients, right? And clients need to say something in the beginning, but they also need to say thanks or not. My grandfather was in a very similar profession as me, right? Exactly the same list, like educator. He made a lot of furniture. But my father, in between us, was a graphic designer. And he was interested in abstraction, more like Johanna, my partner. My personal work, certainly the furniture and the house and the kitchens, it's incredibly people related. Like, it's very humanist. And I really have trouble. Like, I'm very pained by the fact that it's very hard to photograph them with people. I mean, I have to say, like, the stove is a circle and you can stand around it. It doesn't really work to, like, draw people cooking together. I mean, I suppose I could and I try, but it doesn't resonate as clearly. So I'm, like I said, I need that use.
We love details, but it's never about details. Does that describe the balancing between the courage to experiment and the absolute perfection?
Yes, and that's true. And I think that's true for everything that's good, with rare exceptions. Like certain Japanese things, like when it's just sort of obvious, even if it's very refined, if you're not thinking about it too much, it's the most beautiful. I mean, I don't really care about craft. Of course, I really respect the craftsmen who make the things deeply. But when it's really good, you don't notice it.
That's true. To conclude our podcast, we have one final personal question. Dead or alive, Sam, who would you like to swap a day in your life with?
That's a fun question. I wish you'd given me time to work on that one. I think it would be nice to be Michelle Obama. You know, people wish that she would be president. She has this kind of power and elegance, and it feels like she could do whatever she wants and is very careful about it and is exploring things. And I definitely want to be a woman for a day also. And you get to hang out with Barack Obama.
That is a very nice way to end our discussion. Thank you, Sam, very much for your time and the inspiring words, and let us go inside your thoughts and ideas and inspirations. For us, it's time to say goodbye until the next episode of the Jung Talks, the Jung Architecture Podcast.